Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
Well, tomorrow night, as you know, President Bush unveils his new plan for the Iraq War. We will carry his address live on AM 820 WNYC at 9 o'clock tomorrow night. And as you know, its centerpiece is expected to be the so-called troop surge, up to 20,000 more American troops to fight the war, in addition to more money for a jobs program, it's being reported, and some other things. My next guest is one of the leading proponents of sending more troops. But beyond that, Robert Kagan is on a mission to convince Americans that our heritage is not founded simply on a utopian urge to cut ourselves off from the rest of the world and just live our own political and religiously free lives, but also on a messianic mission to change the rest of the world and pursue an expansive foreign policy to do so. And so Robert Kagan has been very prolific lately on two fronts, writing with William Kristol in the Weekly Standard and elsewhere in support of trying to win the war in Iraq militarily rather than abandoning it, and in his new book, Dangerous Nation, America and the World, 1600 to 1898, published by Atlantic Books. Among other things, Robert Kagan was a co-founder of the Project for a New American Century think tank in the 90s that advocated regime change in Iraq before 9/11, is an advisor to John McCain, a Washington Post columnist, and a think tanker at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He is married to the Bush administration's ambassador to the EU and his brother to Frederick Kagan, another leading advocate who you may have seen in the media of sending more troops. Mr. Kagan, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks a lot. Good to be here.
Your book begins at Plymouth Rock, where you tell us that the Pilgrims didn't just come to escape England and Scotland, but to change them.
Well, it's true. The great historian of Puritan thought, Perry Miller, wrote in the 1950s that the Puritan settlement on the North American continent was a flank attack designed to change not America, but to change England and the Protestant world according to the way that the Puritans believed that religion should be pursued.
That's fundamentally different from the way we learn our national creation myth in school, isn't it?
Well, it is, although, you know, so-called revisionist historians beginning in the 60s have been trying to make the point for a long time that America was an expansionist nation from its beginning. That was always the thesis of William Appleman Williams, but I'm afraid their teachings obviously haven't taken hold, because Americans today, even, you know, the most elite foreign policy thinkers seem to believe that the United States is fundamentally historically isolationist, and only sort of in the 20th century or at the end of the 19th did it sort of head out into the world. And I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding of our origins.
You do see the tension between isolationism and expansionism played out among the founding fathers in the early constitutional debates, and you have Washington, Hamilton, Franklin, and Madison as among the internationalists arguing for a strong central government, partly so the U.S. could carry out its responsibilities in the world. But again, as you note, what we learn in school is Washington's farewell address, which warned against foreign entanglements. So how do you square those two?
Well, I mean, the original constitutional debate pitted the people that you mentioned against people like Patrick Henry, who sort of famously declared in opposing the Constitution a kind of sentiment that I think has been repeated throughout our history and even today. He accused Jefferson and Madison and Hamilton and others of wanting to create a great and mighty empire instead of attending to liberty, which was the original purpose of the Revolution. And so we've seen that plenty of times. As for Washington's farewell address, Washington and Hamilton, who had a hand in writing that address, always believed that the United States would become one of the great powers on earth, if not the greatest power. The purpose of Washington's warning in the farewell address was basically to tell Americans to keep their powder dry. While the United States was obviously weak in the 1790s, that was no time to be getting involved in others' wars. But the day would come, Washington says in the farewell address, when the United States would be able to, quote, bid defiance to any other power on earth and go to war or not as it saw fit. And so many Americans regard the Washington's message as being a kind of permanent message, but really it was a temporary tactic that he was suggesting.
But why would that be based on some interest in expanding? Or maybe you should explain what kind of expansionism you have in mind or they had in mind, because at that time, of course, in the Revolutionary War, the colonists, the Americans, were trying to get away from empire and its ravages.
Well, they were trying to get away from one empire, the British Empire, but they were in the process of forming another empire, which was their own empire. You know, I think we all remember that not only after the Revolution, but beginning in the middle of the 18th century, the United States, before it was the United States, Anglo-American colonists began the steady expansion of territory across the North American continent, in fact drawing Britain into a war on the North American continent against France so that people like Benjamin Franklin could acquire the Ohio Valley, which George Washington was also interested in acquiring. And that expansionism continued throughout the first 40 or 50 years after the Revolution. Americans were territorially expansionist, perhaps unlike almost any other power in history except possibly the Roman Empire. But they were also expansionist in an ideological sense, and I think that's where I think people sometimes lose sight of it.
Ideological sense meaning?
Well, because Americans, in their own Declaration of Independence, which was essentially the document of American nationhood, believed in what they regarded as universal rights that could not be challenged. The truth of those universal rights was handed down by the superior being, and therefore there was no other truth available. Those universal rights directly related to American foreign policy from the beginning. Americans believed throughout the first three or four decades of their existence that the fate of republicanism, liberalism, and democracy around the world directly affected America's own well-being. And as the United States grew stronger over the course of the 19th century and certainly into the 20th century, it began to use that power to try to shape the world in its own image. The idea that the world should ultimately conform to the truths that Americans believed they had discovered, I think, animated American foreign policy throughout its history.
So do you see this primarily as do-gooderism, trying to spread the rights of self-determination to people around the world, or more self-interest?
Well, obviously it was both. And the Americans, as they spread across the continent, were certainly mostly looking out for their own interests. As they expanded into foreign markets in the Mediterranean and in Asia and the Pacific, they certainly were out to make money. And I think that there's never been a time when Americans weren't engaged, just like other nations, in selfish pursuits. But they also, and in some respects unlike other nations, have at least tried to convince themselves, and in some cases with some good reason, in some cases perhaps with not such good reason, that they were also spreading the values that they held deeply. There's certainly a strong element of hypocrisy throughout American history, as well as you suggest, selfishness.
We can take phone calls for Robert Kagan. We can talk about, and we will talk about as we go along here, the troop surge proposal and his recommendations and his reactions to the way it appears that it's likely to come down. Last time Robert Kagan was on the program, he was recommending a 50,000 troop surge. So will he see what he thinks about something up to 20,000, at least the way it's being reported in the press so far. We are talking also about his new book, Dangerous Nation, America and the World, 1600 to 1898. And our phone number, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. And let's take a phone call right now. Jim in the Bronx. Jim, you're on WNYC. Jim, are you there? Okay, we'll try to get back to Jim. This is the first of a two-part volume that you're writing, right?
Yeah, that's right. The second volume will go from the turn of the century to, well, something approaching where we are now. I haven't decided exactly where to end it.
I guess maybe you should talk about your use of the word dangerous in the title, Dangerous Nation, applying obviously to the United States.
Well, obviously it's a deliberately provocative title, but I got it from, ironically, from a letter that John Quincy Adams wrote to his father when John Quincy Adams was serving as the ambassador to Great Britain in 1817. And in that letter, he wrote that all the governments of Europe regarded the United States as a very dangerous nation and ardently hoped that it would break up and cease to exist. And I highlighted that because I think that most Americans would be very surprised to think that the world as we knew it at the time in 1817 regarded the United States as a dangerous nation.
Let's try another caller. Andrew in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Andrew.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a longtime fan of the show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to dispute the idea that the U.S. has tried to reshape the rest of the world in its own image. I think we've been rather indifferent to the actual image that we reshaped the world in, as long as the countries that we overturn their governments and install new ones suit our interests. I mean, I'm thinking of, I wish I had a wider knowledge, but Guatemala, the CIA got rid of a democratically elected official in favor of a dictator, a president in favor of a dictator. The same could be, some things along that lines could be said about Saudi Arabia or Iran. And it's ironic that I think the roots of all the terrorism that we face has a lot to do with our indifference towards the governments that we advocate for or install in our countries.
Robert Kagan?
Well, I agree with the caller. There certainly has not been consistency in American behavior. Now, in many of the cases that the caller points to, and there are many more that he could have mentioned, I know the policymakers at the time justified their actions as being in the greater good of eventually being able to shape the world or at least lead the world in the direction that Americans thought was the right direction. Much was justified in the struggle against the Soviet Union throughout the Cold War, including the toppling of some leaders who were at least arguably democratically elected and the imposition or support at least of right-wing dictators. I think the caller is also right to note that the response to the United States, even when it was not engaging in hypocritical action but was simply exerting its influence in a variety of ways, culturally, politically, economically, has frequently throughout history and certainly in recent years brought about an angry response from those who felt that they, their culture, their nation, their region were being shaped in a direction that was not of their choosing. And I think that there's no question that the terrorist actions in the United States, which began, after all, at least 2 decades ago, were a response to, were really a conservative response to sort of the revolutionary effect that the United States was having on the region, as well, again, the caller's right, as being a kind of protest against American support for some dictatorial regimes in the Middle East.
So let me dig deeper on one of those. How much do you think the U.S. Support for the Shah and overthrow of the Mossadegh regime in Iran over 50 years ago got us where we are today by setting up conditions for the radical Islamists to become the only alternative, the only viable political alternative to the Shah and the spread of that around the region?
Well, that's an extremely complicated question. Obviously, the overthrow of the Shah led to the installation of an Islamic revolutionary regime in Iran, which has been the main source of this kind of action ever since. And therefore, it's no coincidence that these kinds of terrorist attacks began roughly in the 80s and have continued ever since. The question of whether it was specifically the overthrow, specifically the support of the Shah, or whether more broadly it was the support of what we like to consider liberalism, modernity. I mean, the Shah, whatever his political inclinations, was trying to wrench Iran into what we consider to be the modern world. And certainly what Islamic revolution...
Certainly not by standing for election, certainly, right?
No. I'm not suggesting that. I'm just saying that certainly a lot of what the Islamic radicalism and terrorism is about is they don't want the Muslim world to become westernized. They don't want the sort of liberal ideas about sex and women to take over. They don't like the way the market economy works. They don't like the way what the Soviets used to call bourgeois democracy. They want to hold on to their own ways, or even return to their old ways. And in that respect, the United States has certainly for some time been the leading obstacle to that kind of revolution.
But arguably, it wouldn't be taking hold to the extent that it is, and I guess, you know, there are many interpretations of just how popular any of this radical Islamism is, but it wouldn't be taking hold to the extent that it is if more people felt that Western civilization, the way they see it, would work better for them. And if the United States is the main proponent and spreader of Western civilization, then there's a tremendous responsibility on the United States as this, you know, missionary foreign power for democracy to kind of do it in the right way. Yes?
Well, I agree. And, you know, I think that there's no question that we've certainly paid a high price for decades of supporting dictators of one kind or another in the Middle East, which have suppressed moderate opposition and produced as the only viable and sort of potent opposition the more radical strains of Islamic thinking.
We'll continue in a minute with Robert Kagan, author of Dangerous Nation, America and the World, 1600 to 1898. We'll get his take on what is expected to be the president's proposal for escalating the war in Iraq. And we'll see where Abraham Lincoln comes into all of this in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Robert Kagan, policy advisor to John McCain, co-founder of the Project for a New American Century think tank in the 90s, author of Dangerous Nation, America and the World, 1600 to 1898, just out from Atlantic Books, and major proponent in op-ed articles recently of sending more troops to Iraq. 19th century, you see Lincoln's Republican Party as framing a pivotal role for the U.S., as someone called it then, in the improvement of the world. How expansionist were the Lincoln Republicans, even on the verge of the Civil War?
Well, the natural tendency of the Republican Party was more commercially and ideologically expansionist than territorially expansionist. And we see the fruits of that later in the century when Republicans from the party that Lincoln founded, sort of leading the way out into East Asia, into Cuba, and ultimately into the Philippines. But what I'm talking about more specifically in the case of Abraham Lincoln, the reason that he and his Republican Party were a turning point, is that the great contradiction in the first eight decades of American history was here was a nation that proclaimed itself supporting universal rights of all men, that all were equal. And at the same time, here was the great slaveholding nation of the world, one of the last and certainly the most powerful. And that contradiction played an enormous role throughout the first half of the 19th century in blunting the kind of tendencies that we saw early after the revolution toward an ideological expansionism. The victory of the North in the Civil War, the victory of the Republican Party, which was then very much the progressive party, the liberal party as we would call it today, set the United States off on a course that was, if anything, more morally driven than it had been before. Those who supported the Civil War and the Reconstruction of the South in the North's image believed that was a moral war. It was a great crusade. And for decades afterwards, leaders like Teddy Roosevelt, McKinley, Henry Cabot Lodge looked back on the Civil War as the great turning point in their lives and the great model of a great war fought for moral ends.
Ernie in Fairfield, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ernie.
Yeah, thank you very much. Back in 1882, the United States had a treaty with Korea for defending Korea, which was in the midst of a bunch of imperial giants. And then in 1905, after the Japanese fleet defeated the Russian Asian fleet, Teddy Roosevelt, recognizing the Japan as a great power, sent his daughter and William Howard Taft over there, made a secret treaty with Japan to colonize Korea, which sent it on a spiral of poverty until the end of World War II. And then at World War II, we split Korea into two, which was just like dividing a family in two and throwing half of it across the bad side of the track.
We'll see if Mr. Kagan agrees with the facts in your telling of history, but
sure.
If they're accurate, why? Because you're trying to make a point, I think. And what is the point?
Well, the point is, Kagan acknowledged, the United States did a lot of things in its foreign policy strictly for selfish reasons.
Robert Kagan?
Well, that's true. And I just want to make it clear, I'm trying to describe the basic impulses that drive American foreign policy outward and that explain what has brought the United States to its present position as sort of the most powerful and expansive power in the world. Along the way, the United States has behaved contrary to those principles on many, many occasions. The interesting thing is, why did the United States sign that treaty with Korea in 1882 in the first place? And ironically, again, given the later history that the caller rightly describes, it was out of primarily humanitarian motives. Americans spent the last two decades of the 19th century trying to protect an independent Korea, which practically only they recognize as independent, against depredations by Japan, by Russia, and by China. And we signed a treaty that I think we had no actual intention of ever really fulfilling, but it stemmed from this sense that we had a special role to play in East Asia in trying to protect a weak and as we saw it at the time, modernizing country like Korea. At the end of the day, we obviously bit off a great deal more than we could chew or were willing to chew, and Teddy Roosevelt sort of rather callously recognized the reality of Japanese superiority and sold the Koreans down the river, which was pretty much the story for the rest of the century until things changed in the 1980s.
And Ernie, thank you for your call. But this is where I think historian Robert Kagan meets policy analyst and advocate Robert Kagan, because you're looking at American foreign policy, the history of American foreign policy, and then I think winding up in a place where you are advocating a fairly, I don't want to use the word aggressive because I don't mean to put a negative connotation on it necessarily, but, you know, to use an expansive foreign policy right now. So do you want to talk about where the history meets your current view of public policy?
Well, first of all historians who also, you know, have things to say about current events face this problem. I mean, I think of Arthur Schlesinger, who wrote some of the greatest histories of American politics and particularly the origins of the Democratic Party, who was also very much a Democratic Party operative during his time. And, you know, the list can go on. Most of the revisionist historians of the 1960s were writing their histories very much with the current war in Vietnam in mind. So it's always very difficult to make that separation. I would argue, in answer to your question, that my views of current American foreign policy are shaped by my understanding of American history and the American character, certainly rather than the other way around. I'm not trying to write a history to fit any particular current policy. And I would point out, just as you've suggested, I began this book in 1996 and was pretty much 90% completed, finished it by 2003. So this book, I wrote this book without George Bush in mind, without the Iraq War certainly in mind. But, you know, if there seems to be a kind of coincidence between my view of American history and my policy prescriptions, I think, you know, one can see the logic of that.
So do you want to give us your thoughts on what we are expected to hear from the president tomorrow night?
Well, I think that, you know, faced with a variety of unpalatable choices, I think the president has decided to try to make a serious effort to bring some measure of success in Iraq before he leaves office and possibly even turn things around. I think the premise of what he's trying to do, or what he seems to be about to announce, is that everyone agrees that there has to be a political solution in Iraq. The problem has been that with so much violence out of control, that has stymied political efforts. You can't expect Iraqi Shia and Iraqi Sunnis and Iraqi Kurds to come to a reasonable political arrangement while Shiite death squads are killing Sunni civilians, while Sunni terrorists are killing Shia civilians.
And that's a big chicken and an egg question right now.
Many
Democrats and some Republicans running around Washington now saying, no, the violence won't have the conditions to stop and cannot be ended militarily until there's a political solution.
No, I know that's the chicken and egg problem is there. The only thing I would say is that we've actually been trying to do the latter ever since this war began. I mean, the amusing thing to me is to hear people coming up with the idea that we should be turning over control to the Iraqis. That was the Pentagon, that was Rumsfeld's and Abizaid's strategy from the very beginning. They were looking to reduce American troops as quickly as possible. They tried to reduce American forces every year in the hope that a political solution would emerge, which would make the military efforts unnecessary. And every year that's failed. The new strategy, and it really is new, attempts to do something that has yet to be done in Iraq since the moment we occupied it, which is to try to produce some basic level of security for individual Iraqis so that political progress can finally proceed.
Now, many Democrats, as you know, are saying they haven't seen descriptions of why this will work in the long run. And here is freshman Democrat Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, a member of the Armed Services Committee, speaking on this program last week.
The case that would need to be made to me is how that is going to be effective. And I frankly have not heard that in the press at all to date. Because if you're saying you want 20,000 to 30,000 more troops in, let's say, Baghdad to create peace and stability in Baghdad, what is going to be the result when you redeploy those troops out of Baghdad? Why would it not return to the levels of violence we have now? So the test that's going to have to be met, at least for me and for our constituency and for a number of the members of Congress, is how exactly do you plan for that to be effective in the long term? Or is it just a short-term buying of time? And if that's the case, that may not be persuasive enough for any vote to support such measures.
So, Robert Kagan, what would you say to Congresswoman Gillibrand?
Well, I think she's put the issue perfectly sensibly and raised quite legitimate questions, which I think the administration will have to answer. I think that trying to figure out what this plan is by reading the press is a very complicated business, because it's very kaleidoscopic. I don't think we've had a full sense of what the plan is going to be. I hope that when the president announces it and he sends his advisors out to brief people, that it'll become clearer. One thing I completely agree with the Congresswoman about is that this can't be a temporary thing where you give it a try for a few months and then you let go and everything goes back to where it started. I think, in fact, the term surge has been somewhat misleading, because I don't think that this is something that can be done over 6 months or 8 months. It's going to take longer than that. And the idea is that if you could bring some semblance of stability where there has been none, that you really can move forward on the political front. But, I mean, of course, this is a proposition that remains to be tested. I don't think anybody can provide any guarantees. But I think that it's up to the administration to make the kind of explanations that the Congresswoman is asking for.
And when you were here last, you were talking about 50,000 troops. That's your proposal. Will this 20,000 we're expecting to hear from the president be enough for the military mission that you envision?
Well, I don't, you know, there's so many different ways of counting figures. I'm a little bit worried that they're on the low side. But I mean, when people talk about what is the size of a brigade, you come up with different numbers. I don't know what the 20,000 means. I think, quite honestly, we're going to have to wait and see what the president exactly says. But I do worry that they're on the light side of where they should be.
Paul in Norwalk, you're on WNYC with Robert Kagan, author of Dangerous Nation, America and the World, 1600 to 1898.
Hello.
Hi, Paul.
Thank you for taking my call. I am immigrant from Soviet Union, and I agree with President Bush when he said that it is ideological war. The only thing, my experience of ideological war cannot be won by military force. I dispute the fact that Soviet Union went down because of Reagan's Star Wars. In 1972, I was still in Soviet Union. And in 1972, I knew that Soviet Union will go down, communism in Soviet Union. And the reason was that our plant manager, Second World War veteran, former party official, and he was staying on the staircase and talking to workers, and he was telling them what he heard yesterday on Voice of America. And at this time, I said to myself, if this person can talk about this with workers, then communism and Soviet Union is gone, because he was the one.
It was going to fall on the basis of the idea and the nature of society,
exactly.
You're saying.
Exactly.
Well, Robert Kagan, do you want to react to Paul?
Well, I mean, there's a quite interesting, you know, debate among historians and analysts as to what exactly caused the downfall of the Soviet Union, but certainly what the caller describes was a big part of it. In fact, you know, back at the beginning of the Cold War, people like George Kennan and Dean Acheson anticipated that the Soviet Union would collapse on its own contradictions, I think was the way Kennan put it, although they expected it actually much sooner than it eventually happened. They were thinking in terms of 20 years. The question of how useful this analogy is to the present issues that we're facing is a difficult one to know. I don't know whether Islamic radicalism will fail on its own contradictions in the same way if given the opportunity to do so in the present international environment. There are those who argue that if you want to see Islamic radicalism fail in the way that the caller is talking about, you actually have to let them take power first. I mean, Islamic radicalism is nowhere more unpopular than in Iran, for instance, where I think the majority of the people are not happy with the way the government rules. On the other hand, Iran is still there. But I just think it's very hard to know whether merely by posing as the alternative, what we call the West, can really make a big difference in this struggle.
Here's an email that asks, could you ask your guest, please, since you are an advisor to Senator McCain, does he hold these expansionist views as well, and is that why he's advocating more troops to Iraq, and will he try to spread our noble goals to Iran as well?
Well, this gives me the opportunity to say that I am not officially an advisor to McCain. I mean, I've spoken to him in the past. I greatly admire him. I actually supported him in 2000 Republican primaries. But I'm not in any capacity an official advisor, and I certainly wouldn't profess to speak on his behalf. He certainly speaks a great deal, expresses his views quite openly, and I think that one can answer that question by just reading what he said.
Well, we know he's for more troops right now, but answer
right.
The listener's question with respect to Iran, and then we're going to be out of time. And your position. I guess the question is, under what circumstances do you think we should use the military against Iran?
Well, I think that the time may come, not necessarily under this administration, but possibly under the next administration, and whether that next administration is Hillary Clinton's administration, John McCain's, Barack Obama's, or whoever wins, they're going to face at some point the decision as to whether to take some kind of military action against Iran or simply allow Iran to finally acquire a nuclear weapon. Just as the Clinton administration in the mid-90s very seriously contemplated taking military action against North Korea, I predict the next president will very seriously consider taking military action against Iran. What that military action will consist of is an interesting question, since I think limited air and missile strikes are likely to raise a great deal of difficulty in terms of Iran's ability to retaliate. So I think that, you know, it's a complicated mission, and it may wind up being a much larger military mission than people imagine today.
You were quoted in one thing I read on taking out the Iranian Navy as well as just its nuclear capacity, and then you said, as long as we've gone that far, we might as well change the regime. Did you mean that literally?
I was just posing this point because I was actually arguing at the time against imagining that you could just undertake an air and missile strike against Iran. I was actually arguing in favor of not taking military action, but trying to affect the regime, both internally and externally. I'm not sure if I still agree with what I wrote then, but in any case, you couldn't undertake a military operation against Iran without dealing with Iran's retaliatory capacities. They can close the Straits of Hormuz and deny Middle Eastern oil to the world. They can undertake attacks on neighboring countries. So I don't think any responsible military planner would not take those into account in military action.
Robert Kagan's new book is Dangerous Nation, America and the World, 1600 to 1898, published by Atlantic Books. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, a follow-up call-in on yesterday's segment about crime and property values in Park Slope. What do you expect for your money when you buy into an expensive neighborhood? Stay with us. Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.